Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I want to move the idea of these gardens away from militarism, but I don't want to move them away from the idea of patriotism.
Rose Hayden Smith's book is about the gardening movement of World Wars I and II. She suggests school gardens should be the next national movement in growing food. Harvest Public Media has a story from Argentina where locusts are wreaking havoc on crops. From the kitchen, a recipe on which to drizzle your maple syrup, and another dish to get you thinking ahead to your spring garden. Farmers want you to get excited about spring now and sign up for their community-supported agriculture programs. We hear how some are trying to make their programs stand out from the competition. And all it takes is water, bones, and time to make broth. We turn to Mark Chilla first thing to hear what's happening with food news.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture wants people who use food stamps to have more healthy options on store shelves. The department this week unveiled new rules that would require retailers to offer at least 7 varieties of each major food group to qualify to accept SNAP payments. Current rules only require 3 varieties in each food group, including dairy, breads and cereals, meat and fish, and fruits and vegetables. The rules would also require that stores keep those items in stock so they don't run out. Stricter requirements could mean fewer stores would qualify to accept SNAP. Convenience stores argue that fewer SNAP stores could take healthy options away from some consumers. The department is considering a waiver for special cases. Researchers in England have found a species of wild tomato that repels pesky white flies. White flies often attack tomatoes grown in greenhouses. They damage plants by sucking out sap and leaving residue that invites mold and other threats. Wild currant tomatoes, which are closely related to domestic varieties, repel white flies and clog their feeding tubes. Researchers say the wild variety could be crossbred with commercial tomatoes to boost resistance, or the genes could be spliced into genetically modified tomatoes if the genes could be isolated. The study, published in the journal Agronomy for Sustainable Development, said that by selecting for characteristics like higher yields and larger fruit, humans might have accidentally bred resistance out of the plant. A story we posted late last week about bad news for supporters of GMO food labeling in New Hampshire. The state's House chamber voted 239 to 122 to kill a bill to require labels for food made with genetically modified organisms. The vote signaled New Hampshire's last chance for a label law passing in 2016. The House Environment and Agriculture Committee had recommended against the bill. In a letter to the union leader, Committee Chair Bob Hafer and Ranking Committee Minority Member Tara Saad explained that they opposed the bill because GMO labeling would be expensive, unenforceable, beyond state responsibilities, and could be unconstitutional. And now to Venezuela. There are widespread shortages of milk, meat, bread, and other staples. President Nicolas Maduro is now calling on Venezuelans to help feed themselves. As NPR reports, home to vast stretches of fertile land, Venezuela could grow much of its own food. Instead, production has collapsed. Economists blame the expropriation of farms and food processing plants, as well as government price controls that force farmers to sell at a loss. Also to blame, falling prices for oil, Venezuela's main export. This means the government has fewer dollars to import food. There's also a severe shortage of imported farm machinery and supplies. President Maduro says he and First Lady Celia Flores produce everything that they eat, and they even have 60 laying hens. These stories are posted at eartheats.org, and they're also making the rounds on Twitter. Find us there at eartheats.
Mark, don't go away. We've got a story from you later on about learning to make bone broth at a food pantry. All right, thanks for your work.
Sure thing, Annie.
The normally dry northern region of Argentina has a problem, one of biblical proportions. And as a major agricultural player, Argentina is a place whose rural problems raise eyebrows in U.S. farm country. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer explains.
Juan Pablo Carnatz raises cattle in Santiago del Estero, about 600 miles northwest of Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires.
It is really, really amazing when you see the locusts, because you see millions of them together.
That's right, locusts. He's seeing dark clouds of the green-brown bugs overhead. When they land, they cover the ground. It's not unheard of for northern Argentina to have locust swarms, but it's been at least 50 years since an outbreak of this magnitude. Carnatz says swarms can stretch to 8 square miles, and they eat everything in their path.
When you think then they can be more millions flying around, it could be a disaster.
He says so far they've mostly been eating from pasture lands, not crop fields, though several thousand acres of mostly onions are destroyed. And he says routine monitoring and control could have prevented the problem. He's more comfortable explaining in Spanish what he thinks happened.
This program was defunded, and only now, with the new government, are they giving it a new push, providing funds for teams dedicated to the fight.
Carnatz's theory has other backers. Catholic University of Argentina agronomy professor Fernando Miguez says that the government can spray insecticides when conditions are favorable for an outbreak.
I guess that the problem was that the government didn't do their job correctly in the past 2 years.
Farmers began seeing the 2-inch-long grasshoppers last June. That's what locusts are. Particular types of grasshoppers who, when their numbers swell, thanks to favorable weather and plentiful food, transition from solitary critters to gregarious masses, ravenous swarms that create dark clouds and devour anything green. The Argentine Agriculture Department is on the job now. Miguez says its efforts could keep the locust from reaching major cash crops, including corn and soybeans.
They are spraying them, but and hoping that it's all the pockets they find and they spray is enough to prevent a swarm to develop.
It will be weeks, if not longer, before anyone knows for sure how localized the outbreak remains, and it could be a year or two before the infested area fully recovers.
The Lord of Hosts will do battle for us.
Locusts are plague number 8, as Moses, or Charlton Heston, proclaimed.
Let my people go.
But as farmers in Argentina can attest, locusts are not just a biblical threat. So what about here? Donald Lewis is an entomologist at Iowa State University.
The good news is, of the several species of migratory grasshoppers that form these locust plagues, none are currently in North America.
We do still have grasshoppers, lots of grasshoppers. In crop fields, many likely fall victim to the pesticides used to control other bugs. But on rangelands,
they actually stimulate plant growth.
Alexander Lachininsky is an entomologist at the University of Wyoming. He says grasshoppers fertilize dry pasture land, and they provide food for sage grouse and other western wildlife. Locust plagues did terrorize pioneer settlers on the Great Plains. Think Little House on the Prairie or the Mormon wagon train. But Lachininsky says loss of habitat mostly dealt with that.
We used to have one locust species, which was a Rocky Mountain locust, infamous in the second half of the 19th century, but it went extinct in the beginning of the 20th century.
So here, at least, we should be safe from locusts. As for the other 9 plagues, you're on your own. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Rose Hayden Smith chose an iconic image for the cover of her book. It was featured on posters back in 1918. Every American would have recognized it. The text above the image reads, "Will you have a part in victory?" And below, "Every garden a munition plant."
And these posters were ubiquitous on the American home front. They were everywhere. And what was really wonderful about the effort is that some of America's finest artists produced the artwork. And so this was actually produced by James Montgomery Flagg, who was a preeminent artist of the era. And this is a depiction of Columbia, you know, which is a depiction of the American state as a strong woman. And what I love about this is that you can see that she's sowing seeds. And if you look at the original of the poster, it's really evident that the landscape is in the shape of an American flag, ready to sort of spring to life. And so one of the things that I love about the World War I and World War II food posters is that they used imagery in very creative ways to not only promote the message of gardening, but the message of patriotism and service to the nation.
So this is the cover of her book, Sowing the Seeds of Victory, American Gardening Programs of World War I. The poster includes a note from the National War Garden Commission saying they'll send you free books about gardening and preserving food. It worked. In 1917, there were 3 million garden plots around the country. That next year, that number went up to 5.2 million American gardens. By 1944, home gardens were producing something like 8 million tons of food, which equaled 40% of all the fruits and vegetables consumed in the U.S. But it was the school gardening program of that era that she says might hold the most relevance to us today.
That school gardening program was one of the first federally mandated curricular programs. It was called the United States School Garden Army. And this program linked school gardens with home gardens. And so the idea was, and it did bear out, that there was sort of a continuous location for youth to garden. And I think that that's very important, that if you really want successful school gardens, that they have to be within the context of an environment that's rich in opportunities to garden both in homes and community settings, so that you have to have a variety of places for youth to be able to garden.
The gardening movement of the early 20th century was spearheaded by the government, and she says that's what we need today, a direct ask for Americans to grow food. She points to First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign to address childhood obesity and the White House garden as ways to frame a discussion of young people growing food.
And so there, I think it would be an opportunity to very explicitly link the production and the consumption and the physical activity as sort of a suite of things, a continuum of things that we must do to contribute to human health and to address the imperative issues surrounding childhood nutrition in this nation, and childhood hunger.
That's how to update the goal to the 21st century. Now, what about the posters?
Well, I have to tell you, I want to move the idea of these gardens away from militarism, but I don't want to move them away from the idea of patriotism, because I actually view the idea of people leading a healthful lifestyle as being an obligation of citizenship. So if I thought about what a poster might be like today and sowing the seeds of victory, that victory might be a victory of being successful in galvanizing engagement, because I think gardens are a wonderful means of civic engagement.
Rose Hayden Smith lives in California and works with school and community gardens. Her book is Sowing the Seeds of Victory, American Gardening Programs of World War I. See that image, the cover of her book, at eartheats.org. Coming up, a bitter vegetable provides balance on the plate.
It's delicious with fatty meats, or if you're going to have, let's say, a pasta and cream sauce, this would be really great because the cream sauce has that really nice, luxurious mouthfeel, and then the bitterness of the broccoli rabe will cut that richness.
Daniel Orr, doing some cooking in the second half. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. The last frost is still several weeks away, but you can get a jump start on the season by starting your seeds indoors. How about some broccoli, Rob, in your spring garden? Maybe you know it as rapini. The buds look a little like broccoli, but it's actually related to the turnip. And yes, you can eat the entire plant.
And it has much more of a bitter flavor. If you have something bitter, it's usually good to add something smoky, salty, and maybe a touch sweet to kind of counterbalance the bitterness. So this is the pancetta, which is like a rolled bacon, but it's not smoked. So I've just diced that up. We're going to add that to the pan. Okay, I've got some pine nuts, maybe about a quarter cup. We want to get those a little toasty. This is a very, very quick dish. Okay, then we're going to add our garlic. And very quickly add our broccoli rabe. Touch of water. Throw in some cherry tomatoes, and the cherry tomatoes are going to give us color. Then those chili flakes and lemon zest. We're going to season this with a little bit of salt and pepper. Now, the bacon's already salty, so you usually don't need too much. Just going to want to eat those tomatoes through. Give it a little taste. Maybe just a pinch more salt. And we're going to add the lemon juice at the very end. And that's going to bring kind of a lively flavor. I like to finish a lot of vegetable dishes with lemon juice. But you don't want to put it in too early because it can make your vegetables kind of go khaki green. I'm going to plate that up.
That pancetta is from Smoking Goose, an Indianapolis-based butcher shop and smokehouse. You can make this recipe with broccoli. There's a recipe for that, too, at eartheats.org. What's good in early spring? Maple syrup. Here's Bob Atkins. It's a basic pancake recipe plus some corn and wild rice.
The key in working with quick breads and pancakes is to do it very quickly, to get everything put together quickly and then make it immediately. So I put flour, salt, and baking powder and baking soda and a little bit of sugar. You can adjust the sugar depending on how sweet you want to make it. So we have our dry ingredients put together. Now I'm putting together my wet ingredients. So I've got two eggs and some buttermilk. If you don't have buttermilk on hand, you can make a sour milk with one cup of milk to a tablespoon of vinegar or lemon juice. That acidity is going to help activate the baking powder and the baking soda and give it that kind of lift and that airiness that you're looking for. And then finally, to this, I've got melted butter. We've got some nice sweet corn that was frozen from this past summer. And some of our pre-cooked wild rice. Make sure you cook the wild rice in advance. Takes about 45 minutes, but you can make a big batch. You can buy a pound or so of wild rice, cook it, freeze it into small batches to use in later recipes. And then this is probably the most important step, is really just bringing together the batter with as few strokes as possible. You don't want to build that gluten. I think probably the biggest mistake people make in making pancakes is over-mixing your batter. A few lumps are okay. Treating it kind of gently, bringing in the dry ingredients up to the top. So now this is set. We want to go ahead and cook this, cook these immediately. So our preheat griddle with a little bit of pan buddy there. We're just going to turn these out onto the griddle. So while those are finishing up, a couple of things I'm going to top this off with. So I've got some ricotta cheese, some whipped ricotta cheese, and some fresh blueberries.
And then a sweetener of your choice, honey or maple syrup. We'll post a picture and the method at eartheats.org. Thanks to both of our chefs for these. Every time we step foot into Mother Hubbard's cupboard, they're doing something incredible. From cooking demonstrations to gardening classes, these events are free and open to the pantry's customers. Many of them wander into the teaching kitchen from the pantry when they smell good smells. What do we have today? It's squash soup on the stove and bones in bags on the counter. Here's Mark Chilla.
My name is Barbara Lair. They call me the domestic diva. Today, we're doing a special topic on bone broth.
Barbara is one of the many volunteers who teaches cooking classes at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. And today, she's brought in a delicious squash soup prepared with her easy-to-make bone broth.
In my home, I have a stock pot going almost all the time. Even though that seems like an odd practice, that was the standard practice before 1930s. Everybody had it. As a matter of fact, I've seen an old-fashioned stove that has three burners and one hole. In that hole, you put a stock pot in, and you had perpetual broth going all the time.
People come to these classes to learn new, healthy recipes that they can hopefully incorporate into their life, like Michael Holland. He's one of the patrons at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
All the recipes I've found for it always have a bunch of sodium in it, and I can't have sodium. So I was trying to figure out whether or not she'd come up with a different way.
Bone broth is not only healthy, it's frugal, too. You're using parts of the animal that you would otherwise just throw away. Plus, it's versatile.
Broth is the basis of the best sauces, the best soups, the best gravies, the best stews.
Part of the mission of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard is to demonstrate just how easy it is for people to make their own healthy food using only simple ingredients. For instance, the ingredients of bone broth are really just bones, water, and thyme.
We'll take bones, we'll roast them, and then we'll put them in a pot, cover them with water, put it to a simmer, and leave it for 24 hours. When we roast them, it's because it gives it a kind of a nuttier flavor. It gives it more dimension to the taste. Some people will put a bay leaf in and peppercorns and a little bit of vinegar to pull the minerals out of
it. The broth can last about 5 days in the refrigerator, 6 months in the freezer, and about a year if it's canned. After the demonstration, Michael, our patron, gets a chance to taste that squash soup made with Barbara's chicken bone broth.
That's actually pretty good. No, you can taste the chicken. What is it, got basil and oregano? That's pretty good.
Now he has the recipe, plus he gets to take some beef bones home to try it out himself. And as Barbara explains, you can cook these beef bones about 3 times before all of the nutrients are out of them. After that, give them to your dogs. They'll love them. For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.
This time of year is important to farmers. They need money up front to buy seeds, new equipment, and maybe hire some more help around the farm. That's where CSA programs come in. Customers pay a flat fee now with a promise of sharing the harvest come spring and summer. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer has a story about how farmers are getting creative to help their CSA stand out.
At Primary Healthcare, a clinic in Ames, Iowa, certified nurse midwife Megan Sloat is seeing a new patient who is pregnant with her first child.
Here in America, we have something called community-supported agriculture, mm-hmm. which is when community members get vegetables from a local farmer. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, allow subscribers to connect directly with a farm and receive produce every week. Sloat's inviting Ala Kahlil to sign up for a farm-to-clinic share through a local farm's CSA at a deep discount, $5 per week instead of $20. Kahlil recently moved here from Jordan with her husband.
The farmers support us with the fruits and veggies, and we are supporting them because they are local and
Kahlil's box will come from Mustard Seed Farm, about 25 minutes away. On a clear spring morning on the farm, Alice McGarry plants potatoes. She runs Mustard Seed with her husband and says she works on it full time, but she doesn't earn any money for her efforts.
So we are a farm that is not for profit. We are a service farm. And so a big part of our service is about food justice, and we just think that everyone should have really good food to eat.
That's where the clinic comes in. Including pregnant women and patients with diabetes in the CSA helps further the mission of getting fresh, nutritious food to anyone who wants it. People who can pay the full price and subsidize the others. McGarry says this arrangement actually attracts some paying customers.
On the marketing question, I think there are people that do join our CSA because of our mission.
Before the mid-1980s, there were no farms in this country offering CSAs. Now there are upwards of 5,000, so competition has gotten stiffer. Gone are the days of "you get what we've got" from farmers relying solely on easy-to-please subscribers. Still, Corey Bregendahl with the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture says we haven't maxed out the number of CSAs the Midwest can support.
Because of the maturation of the business model, I would say no. But in a pure CSA sense, I think the pure CSAs are gone because they were too limiting.
These days, some CSAs let you select what you get in the box, and many farms also market their produce wholesale. Others offer additional meat or eggs or dairy options. Here at Seven Pines Farm near Maxwell, Iowa, Dan Buyer is running a CSA business.
We do a lot of promoting for it and try to get it as big as we can get it.
Buyer's crops are certified organic, and he raises a small number of hogs, chickens, and lambs, which subscribers can buy to supplement their produce.
We have a personal chef that will create recipes for everything that's in the box. So when you get that kohlrabi or eggplant that you've never cooked before and don't know what to do with, she'll have a recipe for you to help you make something out of it.
Let's think about roasting radishes and maybe in a brown butter, and maybe if the tops are present, then you can saute the tops as well. And it's a fantastic side dish.
That's the chef, Holly Wiederin. As she sees it, the farmers give her a chance to help customers enjoy mealtime shows.
Their food becomes the star. I am just a supporting actor here.
Now that consumers can buy fresh local vegetables all over town, they can match their produce with their passion. A social mission, the luxury of a personal chef, or maybe just the convenience of the local grocery store. And back at primary healthcare, patients who can't pay a premium for local are also getting in on the bounty. Maris Bumgars is big and uncomfortable, many days past her due date with her first baby. She's signed up for the farm-to-clinic CSA. It's not that she doesn't buy vegetables.
I do, but usually I buy frozen because it's a little bit cheaper to buy it that way than it is to buy it fresh. So it would be really nice to be able to have fresh fruits and vegetables instead of just the frozen or canned.
And that's something any CSA farmer would be happy to hear. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
The story originally aired last May. Take a note of the website. It's harvestpublicmedia.org. Gratitude to our team, Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Bob Atkins, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. And a special shout out to Liz Leslie, our longtime news blogger, who will be leaving us. Liz, thank you for 5 years of work and well over 400 articles for Earth Eats. Wow, you'll be missed. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Back again next week. Hope you'll be here. I'm Annie Corrigan.